In this Friday edition, we hear excerpts from a town hall meeting presented by Senator Mike McGuire. The topic is the climate crisis in California. He has a panel of experts. They address the situation and give some advice.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are grateful that you are with us tonight. My name is Mike McGuire, and I'm honored to be able to work with you in the California State Senate representing the North Coast in the Bay Area. Town hall on the climate crisis. And I want to be candid here tonight. The alarm could not be louder. Climate change is here. The evidence is clear, and the impacts are dangerous. Experts believe that climate change has made California and the American West warmer and drier over the last 20 to 30 years. Extreme heat is now the top weather-related killer in the United States. Western states are now more susceptible to extreme drought and larger, more destructive, and more frequent wildfires. Our coastal communities are already experiencing early challenges with sea level rise. And we know that California's climate has always been variable. But those last couple of decades have been some of the hottest on record here in the Golden State. And we also know that this crisis is evolving faster than anticipated. And communities big and small, up and down the California coast, are starting to witness climate change damaging impacts. And if we don't act to mitigate climate change, our kids' lives, our grandkids' lives, will be worse off than what we're seeing here today. And that's why the legislature here in California just acted. We approved the single largest investment in climate action in the history of the Golden State. Over $15 billion in funding to tackle the growing wildfire crisis in the state was allocated. We'll be investing in drought response and resiliency, helping communities prepare for extreme heat and sea level rise. And we're advancing funding for more sustainable agricultural practices. This investment is truly a nation-leading climate package. And while Californians have historically led this nation on emission reduction efforts, now more than ever, we have to redouble our focus to combat this growing crisis. And that is why we are so grateful that you have joined us here for this informative evening. And we are so honored that we have some of the top experts in America on climate change who are joining us. With us tonight, we are grateful. We have climate scientist Daniel Swain. He's from the Institute of Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. We have Christina Dahl here. She's a senior climate scientist from the Climate Energy Program with the Union of Concerned Scientists. We have Peter Miller. Peter is the Director of Climate and Clean Energy with the Natural Resources Defense Council here in the Western Region. By the way, we have just got word we are now over 4,000 strong from all across Northern California joining us for this climate crisis town hall. Thank you so much for tuning in this evening. And Daniel Swain. Mr. Swain is a climate scientist with the Institute of Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. Mr. Swain is going to be focusing on a few very important issues. Number one, how do we know that climate change is here? Two, how does climate change evolve in California and the American West? Mr. Swain, we welcome you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks again for the invitation to join this conversation this evening. I'm really encouraged to hear that there are 4,000 people who are going to participate, because I think that's certainly the first stage in solving the underlying problem, is engaging and talking about it. So that's what we're going to do this evening. I study the atmosphere and the ways in which it's changing over time, and in particular, the ways in which this changing atmosphere is affecting weather and extreme events like droughts and floods and wildfires, the kind of stuff that really concerns us all. And here to tell you tonight is that climate change is here, no longer a prediction about something that's going to happen in the future tense. This is an observed reality all around us today, a much more visceral experience for a lot of people in California over the past 5 years or so, because we have seen so much drought and so many wildfire disasters on a level that we really hadn't seen before. How do we know that the climate has changed, not just over decades, but over the past century? we really have multiple lines of evidence, the most obvious of which are thermometers tell us that the Earth is warming. We can look at things like the continental ice sheets or Arctic sea ice and see that the ice is melting. We can confirm all of these observations by looking down at the Earth from Earth orbiting satellites, which essentially gives us more or less the same picture. We can also test these hypotheses using mathematical models, often called climate models, which help us conduct controlled experiments that we can't do on the Earth itself. All of these independent lines of evidence lead us to an inevitable conclusion, which is that the Earth is warming and that the human emission of greenhouse gases is by far the dominant reason why that is happening. And so I think in California, the signs and symptoms are a little bit different than in other parts of the world. And I think one of the most obvious ones is that California is a much warmer place than it used to be, not just because we're seeing more extreme heat waves, but equally importantly, we're seeing warming at cold times of year and in cold places. So we're seeing even faster warming in some cases in winter and in the mountains. And so that's having an effect on things like snowpack, which is decreasing, which is affecting water supply and the level of drought severity in this part of the world. We've also seen, in addition to an increase in the mean snow line and a decrease in the amount of snowpack, a decrease in the amount of water that's available on the landscape. And that's not so much because we're seeing less precipitation falling from the sky. It's more because it's so much warmer, but there's more evaporation. So we're seeing an intensification of this water cycle. And what we expect to see in a warming California, and something that we're already starting to see, are shifts in precipitation patterns, even in places where the overall amount of precipitation isn't necessarily decreasing. We've already started to see this with precipitation seasonality. We're used to wet winters and dry summers with shoulder seasons in between in the spring and fall. What we're starting to see are drier falls and drier springs, but not necessarily drier winters. And so what we're seeing is a sharpening of that existing seasonality in California's precipitation, along with the warming and the increased evaporation. So what does this mean? Well, it means we've seen a lot more drought, and we've seen a great number of extreme precipitation events interrupting those droughts, all while our average precipitation hasn't changed a great deal over time. One of the challenges that results from this, in addition to increasing drought severity, is an increase in the intensity and severity of wildfires. And so this is one of the reasons, the increasing aridification of the landscape due to warming is one of the key reasons why we've seen such an escalation in California's wildfire crisis over the past several decades. It certainly isn't the only reason, but it is a major contributing factor. And something that we haven't seen so much in recent years, but is a significant concern to the scientists who study this sort of thing, is that we may eventually flip the hydrologic coin to the other side of the spectrum. In other words, we've been worried a lot about drought and water scarcity recently for understandable reasons. We've endured two of the worst droughts in California's history over the past decade. The second one is currently ongoing. But in a warming climate, we also expect to see much more intense atmospheric river storms, these intense bursts of rainfall during our rainy season that can lead to flooding and other sorts of problems. And so as the climate warms, in addition to this increasing scarcity of water much of the time, those dry periods are more likely to be interrupted by large storm events and major floods. And even though that's something we haven't seen recently so much, it looms large in climate risk projections for this part of the world. This leads to what we have termed in our own research, an increase in precipitation whiplash, this notion that you go increasingly from one side of the spectrum where things are very dry to the other where conditions are very wet in quick succession and alternate back and forth with increasing frequency. The overwhelming indicator of climate change has been through these rising temperatures and an increasing water scarcity. This is true all across the Colorado River watershed, which supplies a good portion of California with its water, as well as in the Golden State itself. So this is not a problem that's isolated to California. This is something that's happening really all around the American West. I think one of the messages that I'm hoping to convey tonight is that while this is a very big global problem that we are not yet taking seriously enough, not taking essentially the measures that are commensurate with the scale of the problem yet. It is eminently a solvable problem still, even today, if we do the right thing and actually take the problem as seriously as the reality appears to be all around us. And I think we've had lots of evidence of that just this past summer, not just here with the wildfires in California, but all around the world over the past year or so with the extreme floods and extreme heat waves you've seen on multiple continents. And in California, there are some potentially unique opportunities to not only mitigate climate change by bringing emissions to zero and eventually solving the underlying problem, but also to adapt to the kinds of changes that we know are coming. The increase in extreme weather events and extreme droughts or extreme floods, for example. California is a place that sees a fair bit of both of these things. And so it might be possible, for example, to use excess water that occurs that is present during the floods of the future to mitigate the drought risks of the future. When it comes to wildfire, most ecologists and fire scientists agree that one of the most promising avenues for reducing risk is to literally fight fire with fire and reintroduce or expand policies of prescribed or managed wildfire at a much lower intensity to avoid the catastrophic fires later on.
We are now going to be turning it over to the senior climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Tina Dahl is with us. She really focuses and specializes in extreme heat as well as sea level rise. She's going to be focusing on both of those aspects that are related to climate change. She's going to be talking about the impacts of climate change on people's lives across the nation, what can be expected in the future. She's also going to be offering some solutions to us here this evening. Ms. Dahl, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for being part of this event tonight. I'm often asked whether there are things that give me hope when we are facing the climate crisis. And the fact that there are thousands of you listening and dedicating up your free time after work to be thinking about climate change with us is part of what gives me hope that we are all in this together and wanting to solve it together. For many of us in California, wildfires and drought weigh very heavily on our minds. And certainly the things that Daniel was just talking about are things that we are all concerned about. Will we have enough water? Will our forests be intact? Will they be burning? And part of the reason these weigh so heavily on us is for a very good reason, right? There are images that we see every year of people's homes being reduced to ash, cars jamming a one-lane road trying to get out as flames are licking at their car doors. But as we grapple with this particular manifestation of climate change, people in states far from California are battling with different, but in many cases, equally harrowing manifestations of our changing climate. There's really nowhere one can go to escape the reality of our changed and changing climate. I want to talk about the two threats that California is facing that I've worked on in recent years, extreme heat and sea level rise. Frequency of extremely hot days. So those would be days where there's a heat index or a feels like temperature above 100 in California are poised to triple between now and the middle of the century if we fail to reduce our carbon emissions globally. More days that are dangerous to the health of everyone who's outdoors, but particularly people whose jobs require them to be outside. They are the people who are picking and harvesting our food and making sure that we have a beautiful salad on our plates at dinner time. They're the people who are delivering our packages during a pandemic so that we can stay safe at home. Within that mid-century timeframe, there are also about 20,000 homes across California's coasts that are at risk of chronic flooding due to sea level rise. As with so many of the impacts of climate change, both sea level rise and extreme heat fall particularly hard on low-income communities and communities of color in California. So while we are already feeling the early effects of climate change today, there are much more severe impacts headed our way if we don't reduce our heat trapping emissions now. So to minimize the impacts of global warming, we have to quickly and fully wean ourselves off of burning fossil fuels, transitioning every car, every home to run on clean electricity. Because that can't happen in a day or even a year or even 5 years, we also have to be preparing ourselves and our communities for more frequent extreme heat, larger wildfires, more intense storms, greater uncertainty about when and where and how much water is going to fall. California has already demonstrated really out of the box, leading edge thinking about this problem, both historically and in recent years. Just to name one program, the state is exploring the idea of buying out homes that are at risk from sea level rise at a fair value to the current homeowners, and then renting those homes out either to the current homeowners or to others until they can no longer be occupied because of sea level rise. That's something that no other state in the country is thinking about or talking about, and is the sort of innovative solution we need to be thinking about. So it's going to take much more to get from where we are today to a future that's safe for everyone. More bold visions, more money, more of a focus on how to right the historical wrongs of racism that are currently putting people of color at greater risk. The thing it can't take is more time. We have a narrow window of time in which to avert some of the worst consequences of climate change. And so it's imperative that we begin to act now.
We're going to hear now from Peter Miller. Peter is with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Peter's really going to focus on the Golden State, discuss California's leadership on the climate crisis, the fact that more work is needed immediately. He's going to be talking about where he believes the Golden State needs to move in regards to a carbon reduction strategy. He's going to also talk about the consequences of not moving now. And we hear this a lot, Peter. How does California and the United States push countries like China to do the right thing when it comes to climate change? And Peter, we welcome you, sir, to the program. Thank you so much for joining us. It's good to see you. The floor is yours.
The state of California has a unique opportunity and a responsibility to be a leader on climate change. We live in the most populous and prosperous state in the country. We have the clout and the resources to take on a leadership role. We have a responsibility to take action in order to protect the lives and the welfare of California citizens and our environment. And we have unique authority under the Clean Air Act that helps us to do that. We have to clean up our own act, but that's just a starting point. We can't solve this problem by ourselves. We can't just reduce our emissions in California and expect to solve the problem of climate change. We need to create a model in California that other states and countries can and will emulate and adopt. We need to develop and implement policies that are effective, affordable, and help build a more prosperous future. We've taken strong leadership in the past. In 2002, California passed legislation to adopt greenhouse gas emission standards for cars. These standards allowed other states to choose a more ambitious requirement than the national standard, and eventually became the basis for national vehicle emission standards. In 2006, California passed legislation to cap and reduce statewide emissions back to 1990 levels by 2020. We met that goal 4 years early, and are now developing a plan to meet a much more ambitious goal for 2030. In 2010, California passed a requirement that one-third of the electricity consumed in the state come from renewables. We beat that goal ahead of schedule and below cost, and we're on track to meet the new requirement that 60% of all electricity come from renewables by 2030. Every single time we did this, opponents have said, it can't be done, it's too expensive, or it's too difficult. They were wrong. These actions didn't hurt California. Rather, they helped California be a leader in building the industries of the future. Now, nearly 500,000 Californians are employed in the clean energy economy, representing 28% of the state's construction workers, 6 times more workers than in the entire fossil fuel sector. And the state's most valuable export, electric vehicles, producing nearly $5.7 billion in revenue last year alone. Looking forward, there's so much more that needs to be done. So I want to highlight some of the key actions that we need to focus on going forward. First, the overall strategy. We need to clean up electricity and then run our homes, vehicles, and businesses off that clean electricity. We can do this. It's challenging, but the technology already exists and costs are coming down. It's really critical to note, a clean energy grid is not more expensive. The obstacles are political. They're not technological or economic. We can do this. Second, transportation is key. It accounts for more than 50% of our emissions. We have a robust set of policies in place, but we really need to step on the gas. And we also need to come up with a better figure of speech for moving forward aggressively. Heavy industry is key. Cement is responsible for 8% of global CO2 emissions. We need strong standards to transition to cleaner building materials. And I want to highlight that the legislature passed and the governor signed an important bill to move forward in that area. And then finally, we need to invest in our natural and working lands. Given, Rick, I know a lot of you live in beautiful places near forests or agriculture, rivers and streams. We need to act to protect our homes and our communities. And we need to restore and sustain our forests, our agriculture, our fisheries, and our treasured natural places. We need to turn these lands from sources of CO2 to sinks. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, we need to center equity in our policy and in our action. The threat of climate change is greatest to those that have borne the brunt of environmental degradation for decades. We need to invest in these communities and in our people. We're in this together. The budget. As the senator mentioned, the legislature took a historic $15 billion from the budget surplus this year and directed it to investment in climate action. A lot of these funds will flow to communities and businesses across this part of the state. I want you to keep your eyes out for innovative investments in forest resilience and drought response and climate smart agriculture and other important programs that are going to be rolling out soon. Second, the Air Resources Board is developing a blueprint for meeting our 2030 goal. They have their work cut out for them. The pace of reductions has to increase fourfold to get to the 2030 goal. A key focus in that effort will be on how we integrate national and working lands into that plan and how we turn those lands from sources of emissions to growing sink. And finally, just a month from now, world leaders will be gathering in Scotland to negotiate an international agreement on how to address the threat of climate change. California has been a leader on the world stage for many years, given our leadership. And we will have a substantial presence at that meeting. Fortunately, this time we'll be joined by a national delegation led by a president who's committed to strong climate action.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Christina, Daniel. Thank you so much. Kelly wants to know, what is the number one thing that we can all do to curb climate change? Christina.
There's so many things that one can do, but because this problem can't fall on the shoulders of individuals alone, the number one thing you can do is hold your elected officials accountable. Anytime someone is running for office, make sure that climate change is a priority for them and that they are going to do everything they can to address it. Because I have a few more seconds, I will also say, anytime you are making a big choice in your life, like buying a car or where to live, make the lowest carbon choice you can. We all have things that we can do. We all have things that are going to be difficult for us to do. And so just bringing that awareness and intention into your everyday life is an important thing as well.
All right, Daniel, what is the number one thing we can do to help curb climate change?
You know, I couldn't agree more with Christina that the number one thing that everyone can do, and this truly everybody can do, regardless of your means or your circumstances, is to A, talk about it, and B, be politically engaged, because this is no longer a problem that we don't know how to solve. We know how to solve the problem of climate change. It's just that we aren't doing the things collectively as a society that we need to do to solve the problem. And it's not an individual burden. It's a collective problem. It's a global problem that's going to require global solutions. And so, and to make it easier for individuals to make the kinds of good choices, it comes down to essentially being engaged and talking about the problem.
Peter Miller, number one thing folks can do to combat climate change.
Well, I'd say Christina hit it out of the park here. I completely agree with her. People should get politically engaged and hold your elected leaders accountable. That's the number one thing we can do, from local to the state, to the national level. I'll second what Christina said as well. When you're making important choices in your life about the vehicle that you're gonna own or the appliances that you have in your home, look for the most efficient, low carbon alternatives. And contact your local utility, your water utility, your electric utility, and ask for their assistance. They should be there supporting those investments.
Christina, a question about in California when it comes to methane production. Who produces more and what do you see as solutions?
They do know that transportation emissions are the largest category of emissions in California. So a lot of our communities developed with a car culture. It's not always easy to decarbonize, as we say, or electrify that transportation emissions. So that's going to be something that we need to be incentivizing more and more as a state. And as more and more electric cars come onto the market, hopefully we'll start to see prices drop as well so that we don't need such large subsidies from the state or federal government to make those affordable within the state.
Christina, do you believe that all the low-hanging fruit has been picked, right? I mean, we need to start looking at bold solutions to be able to slow the speed of this climate crisis. I mean, we're going to have to eventually look at a phasing out of the combustible engine here in California if we truly hope to make a significant dent in this climate crisis. Christina, your thoughts?
Yeah, we do. We need a transformation of the way we use energy in our world, not just in California. But I would disagree with the statement that all the low-hanging fruit has been picked. A really large fruit that's still out there on the tree is energy efficiency in our buildings. You know, many of us live in older homes, old windows, leaky, letting in all the heat, all the cold. There's a lot that we can already do with the solutions we have that we haven't fully deployed yet.
Mark writes in, Daniel, that he wants to know, are climate changes likely to make the Pacific Northwest hotter and drier as well? What does it look like over the next 20 to 30 years when it comes to climate change on the west, for the West United States?
It's a good question, and it's actually not a very simple one to answer, because depending on which part of the west of the Rockies you're talking about, the answer is pretty different. Now, the shared commonality across regions, whether we're talking in the Pacific Northwest or Southern California or the Great Basin, it's getting warmer. We're going to see more extreme heat and less extreme cold. That's true everywhere in the West. But when it comes to precipitation, the interesting thing is the Pacific Northwest is actually expected to get significantly wetter. So the wet places in the West are pretty likely to get substantially wetter. And some of the really dry places in the desert Southwest are more likely to get drier. So unfortunately, I don't think that's the pattern that a lot of people would like to see. It's going to amplify the differences between the wet and the dry regions.
I get to a comment and question that Judy has written in. She says, no, exclamation mark. Climate change is just another left-wing ploy to gain control and scare people who are too stupid to think for themselves. She then says in all capitals, the climate has changed since time began and there's nothing we can do about it to change it. Mother Nature is watching you, beware. So Daniel, talk to Judy. What would you say to her? And is this political or is this real?
Well, I actually get a lot of feedback, and I think it is worth talking about. There's a couple of points in there that are actually correct. One of which is that the climate is always changing. I guess the second one's an opinion. I would agree that Mother Nature is always watching you. But when it comes to the reality of climate change, it's not political. It's unfortunately become partisan, but it really shouldn't be political because it's just a factual reality. You can go look at glaciers. There are people alive today who grew up living near glaciers around the world that look vastly different today than it did when they were children. So we know the climate is changing. There's no doubt about that. But the more interesting question is how we know why human activities are the reason why the climate has changed this time. And it's true that the climate in the past and even in the present is changing because of natural factors that have nothing to do with humans. That's always been true. It always will be true. But the problem right now is that the rate at which the climate is changing because of human activities completely outpaces any of the natural changes that are occurring at the same time. And so the real issue here is not that humans are the only force in the universe capable of changing Earth's climate. It's that at the moment, we are the dominant force on this planet changing the climate, and it's changing way faster than it would have from natural factors alone.
We have been listening to excerpts from the town session brought to you by Senator Mike McGuire. regarding the climate crisis in California. The Friday edition is a production of KIDE, Hoopa Tribal Radio. The producer and engineer of this segment has been Joseph Orozco. For KIDE, we thank you for listening.